You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
The book of Acts, which is right after the four Gospels, explains how you get from Jerusalem all the way to Rome with Jesus' message of forgiveness. How did that happen? How does it travel 2,500 miles? Well, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Right now, we're only in the first missionary tour. We saw the opening of this last week, and then now we're seeing the rest of it this week. They left from Antioch, Syrian Antioch. They went down to Cyprus. They moved up to Perga, and then to Pisidian Antioch. They were chased out of there. And they're going to go to Iconium to the east, and then to Lystra, 20 to 30 miles to the south, and then 60 miles east to Derbe. Everyone got that? There's going to be a test. That was a lame joke. We're going to keep moving. Verse 1. At Iconium, Paul and Barnabas went as usual into the Jewish synagogue. So Iconium to the east. There in Iconium, they spoke so effectively that a great number of Jews and Greeks believed, came to know Christ. But the Jews who refused to believe stirred up the other Gentiles, and they poisoned their minds against the brothers. So Paul and Barnabas spent considerable time there. They spoke boldly for the Lord, who confirmed the message of his grace by enabling them to perform signs and wonders, miracles. The people of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews, others with the apostles. There was a great plot among both Gentiles and Jews, together with their leaders, to mistreat them and to stone them, to kill them in a brutal way. But they found out about it, and they fled to the Lycaonian cities of Lystra and Derbe and the surrounding country. Originally, critics thought that Luke got this wrong. They thought that this was akin to saying they fled from England into London. You with me? London's in England, right? So to say that they fled from Iconium in Phrygia into the Lycaonian cities of Lystra and Derbe, they thought that that was wrong. Turns out Luke was right. Luke was right. This whole geography, he had this down to a T. Well, in Lystra, there sat a man who was physically disabled. And he had been that way from birth, and he had never walked. He listened to Paul as he was speaking. Paul looked directly at him and saw that he had faith to be healed. So Paul called out, "Stand up on your feet!" At that moment, the man jumped up and began to walk. Oh, when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lycaonian language. This was a dialect of Koine Greek in this region. So Paul and Barnabas were probably listening to this, not quite grasping what they're saying. And they shouted out, "The gods," Paul and Barnabas, "the gods have come down to us in human form." Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul they called Hermes because he was the chief speaker. Paul was like, "Why couldn't I be Zeus?" Barnabas, he must have been bigger. Paul was a short guy. Anyways, why were they saying this? Why would they jump to these two Jewish men must be gods? Why would you think that? Here's why. Ovid, the ancient playwright, back in 43 BC, wrote a legend wherein in this region, Lystra, guess who? Zeus and Hermes, disguised as mortals, came into a village, and as they entered into the village, they knocked on every door. Nobody answered. Everyone shunned them, put them away. But they came to the cottage of this old couple, and they let them in, and they fed Zeus and Hermes, and then they realized, as they were feeding them, these were not ordinary mortals. They were gods. So Zeus and Hermes took this old couple up onto a hill. And from the hill, They looked down and they saw the town, and Zeus was like, I'm going to flood it and kill everybody. And they were like, okay. So they flooded everything except for their cottage, which they turned into a temple of Zeus. End of story. This legend from 4 centuries before the time of Jesus had been growing up in this area. So they see 2 men who look like mortals coming into their region, performing miracles, and they're wondering, this has got to be Zeus and Hermes. They're speaking in this specific language. Paul and Barnabas are like, yeah, hey, they like us. This is good. Better than getting stoned. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought bulls and wreaths to the city gates because he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifices to Paul and Barnabas. But when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard about this, they tore their clothes and rushed out into the crowd. Ripping your clothes was not just for, you know, WWE wrestlers back then, all right? This was a Jewish thing that you would do if you were really, you know, somber, if you were grieving, if you were enraged, angry, you would tear your clothes. This was one of the most valuable things that you owned. We can just go to the store, get a new shirt. Back then, that's what they had. And ripping it open meant like, whoa. I mean, that would be like, you know, burning your car, sending your car on fire. It meant something serious. So they ripped their clothes. Very different than what we read about Herod. Remember when they worshiped Herod? Herod was like, yeah, give me more. Paul and Barnabas were like, no. They said, friends, why are you doing this? We too are only human like you. We are bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things. What are the worthless things? Zeus, Hermes, idols, false gods, to the living God. Yeah, hardly anybody today would say that Zeus is real, that Hermes is real. I mean, I like Percy Jackson as much as the next guy, okay? And I read Sea of Monsters in preparation for December 10th when the new show comes out on Disney Plus. Yes, I did. That's a public confession, okay? But I don't believe that Zeus is real. I don't believe that Poseidon is real. I don't think that you need to propitiate Poseidon if you're going on a cruise, you know, that the cruise would go really well, because there is no Poseidon. There is no Zeus. These are worthless things. There's only one true God. There's the real God. Spiritual reality is like any other reality. We don't get to make it up any more than you get to make up things about science or literature or law. You don't get to make that up. You need to actually discover, not determine, reality. So, how is it that Paul is going to show these polytheists? You know what that word means, right? Poly meaning many, theist meaning God. They believe in many miniature gods: Poseidon, Zeus, Dionysus, Hermes, Hera, etc. How can he show that they're not the true God, that there's only one true God? Well, the very next words out of his mouth are these: God, the true God, made the heavens and the earth. In literature, this is referred to as a merism. A merism. We searched high and low. You're telling me you didn't search in between? Is that what you mean? No. It's a merism, right? We searched high and low, and that means everything in between. He created the heavens and the earth. And just in case you're a little bit slow on the pickup here, and everything in them. God created everything. In the words of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. God is the infinite, personal God, creating everything. He is the uncreated creator. So, the first argument that Paul gives is that God created the entirety of the universe, the origin of the universe. People back then didn't like this. They believed in an oscillating universe. there was what was called in Greek the palingenesia. Palin meaning again, genesia meaning genesis. The universe would go through cycles over and over and over. Created, burned, disintegrated, created, burned, disintegrated, on and on and on. Or in Epicurean Stoic philosophy, the universe had just always existed. But the idea that there was nothing, and then God acted, and then there was everything, this was unknown in the ancient world, except among these strange people, the ancient Jews and Christians. They were the one group that said, no, no, no. The world, the universe, is contingent on God, God's existence. Yeah. 2,000 years later, this view, what we're reading, is the consensus view in modern cosmology and physics. It's really a shock in the last 100 years. When you would think that science and religion are at loggerheads the most, actually, what we've been discovering through the microscope and the telescope has shown that biblical Christianity, biblical theism, belief in God, is more rational to believe now than ever before. What we believe now is that the universe had a space-time, matter, and energy beginning. It's what's referred to as the Big Bang. Now, how many people here have heard of the oscillating universe model? Good. That's really good. How many people have heard of the static state model? Really good. Wow. How many people here have heard of the Big Bang theory? Okay, good. There's a reason that you all know that. Because you passed high school, okay? This is in every textbook. It's not a Christian, it's not creation science. It's not like you find this in a weird museum where they build a big ark, nothing like that, okay? This is just in every textbook, Big Bang cosmology. In fact, the term Big Bang came from an atheist, Fred Hoyle, who said, you're saying that the universe came into existence from nothing? Well, that sounds like a big bang. And they said, great name. And that's where we got the term Big Bang. Everything came from nothing. Yeah, that's pretty fortuitous for us today to look at the universe and to say, wow, it all came from nothing. I wonder what could cause a Big Bang. Seems like you'd need a big banger to have a Big Bang. No? All right. Yeah, here we are, man. How did it get here? Every other effect in the universe, the principle of sufficient reason. If there's an effect, you need a sufficient cause, right? Like right now, if we felt a grenade go off outside, sorry, I shouldn't say that. If we felt like a big, boom, loud noise, outside the window, everyone here would jump up and say, what caused that? What if I was just like, sit down, nothing caused that, nothing caused that? I think you would say, no, you're wrong, something caused that. Why? Because you believe in the principle of sufficient reason. Effects have adequate causes. There's got to be a cause behind it. Well, if little bangs in the parking lot require a cause, big bangs require causes as well. Verse 16, in the past, He let all nations go their own way. God is letting people have free will. Yet, God has not left himself without a testimony. Even though he's letting people go, he's showing that he's real. How? He's shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. So the first line of argument, he says, is that you can't get the universe from a mini-god, a demigod, a Zeus, Hera, something like that. You need an infinite personal god to get everything. Then he's just making that very intuitive notion that when you look out at the world, you see the hallmarks of organization, that there is a certain specificity to the world. On the microscopic level, the cell, the subatomic particles, atoms. But then on the macroscopic level, you look out at the universe and you see design. I hate to use that word, but there it is. Design. that there's design in our universe. Here, I don't know if Paul knew modern physics. I don't think he did. I think if you said physics, Paul would say, what's physics, right? However, he's just looking out at the world and he's saying, look, this whole world was designed. You don't get that from a demigod. You need a personal agent, but it needs to be an infinite personal agent. That's what you need. Well, is it reasonable to see design in nature like this? Is that reasonable? I'm going to argue, obviously. It is obviously the case that it's reasonable to see design in nature. Imagine you're with your special somebody on a stroll on the seashore. And as you're walking and talking and looking into each other's eyes and looking out at the beauty of nature, you come across this image here. And you look at that and you say, how did that get here? Huh? What could explain that? What could explain design on this scale? Well, you would need a sufficient explanation, wouldn't you? I don't think that happened by chance. Now, there's water, I don't know if you noticed, in the background, there's water that could have pushed all of those natural grains of sand into that place, right? And there's a lot of waves. I mean, this has been going on for 4 billion years here on planet Earth. Wave after wave after wave, there's sufficient movement to get all of those grains of sand up on the shore in that way. In that way. See, that's our problem. See, when I look at that, I see spheres, I see right angles, I see stairs. What I'm seeing is not just sand. I'm seeing something that fits an independent, specified pattern. Right angles, the same amount of legs for each stair, circles, squares, spheres, all of that. Now, I'm not going with the hypothesis that it's just the waves. That doesn't make much sense. Could it be hermit crabs? Maybe there's a lot of them. They can move those pieces of sand. Now see, they don't have that ability. They don't have intelligence to bring all of those pieces of sand together. Wind? Wind? Could wind do it? Hard to believe. I just don't believe that. I think when we look at that right there, I think it's very clear what we're seeing is that that was designed. And we can know that. We can know that. Even if we don't know the designer, we never met her or met him. We can know that there was a designer behind that, just as surely as we can know anything else in life. Well, you never met the designer. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. The wind hypothesis, the waves hypothesis, the hermit crab hypothesis doesn't make any sense. It's possible, yeah, it's possible, highly implausible. What makes sense of seeing something designed? A designer. That's what we would say, yeah. Well, is there an element of design in our universe? Yeah. In the last 50 years, since Brandon Carter, 1974, scientists have discovered that the universe itself, I don't mean biology, I mean physics. The laws of physics, the four fundamental forces, strong, weak force, gravity, electromagnetism, and then the constants, and then the initial conditions of the Big Bang, were finely tuned. Now, right there, you might say, that's really prejudicial language. You're calling it fine-tuning. Like there's a fine... Okay, that's not my words for it. Secular scientists use that language. They're the ones who created it. Fine-tuning is not a Christian term. It's a scientific term. Fine-tuning. Like, what do we mean by fine-tuning? What examples do you have? Let me give you a few. The Q constant, this is the uniform temperature of the cosmic microwave background radiation. Right after the Big Bang, there was residue radiation. And this is uniform in the universe. And it is finely tuned to one part in 10 to the fifth power. You remember your exponents? 5 zeros after a 1. Finely tuned to one part in 100,000. Pretty amazing. if it was off by just a little bit, that microwave radiation in the scope of the universe, if it was decreased in uniformity, there would be no stars, no planets. If it was increased, these stars would be too close together, so you wouldn't have stable planets. So people like to say, well, neo-Darwinian evolution can explain all this, right? No. Wrong. Absolutely wrong. No stars. No planets. No stars upon which you can have life evolve. So this is a runaround, neo-Darwinian evolution. That doesn't explain anything at all. All right. Some of you are like, 1 in 100,000. That's pretty good. What else you got? All right, the weak nuclear force. This is the force that keeps nuclei together, you know, nucleus in the atom, keeps it together. This is finely tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 9th. 9 zeros, what would that be? 1 billion. 1 part in 1 billion. 1 in 1 billion chance. If this was off by 1 part in 1 billion, you would have no supernovae. Supernova, singular, is when the star goes boom and it seeds the universe with life essential properties, parts of the periodic table that you need for life. If you don't have supernovae seeding the universe with these different parts of the periodic table, you don't have a periodic table, hence you don't have life. So, wow, that was fortunate. 1 part in 1 billion. All right, what about the omega constant? This is the mass density of the universe. This is finely tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 24th. I don't have a number for that, like 1,000, million, billion. And then I just sound like a little kid, you know what I mean? Like a quazillion, and I don't have a number for it. But a 1 with 24 zeros after it. 1 part in 10 to the 24th power. If the mass density of the universe was off by 1 part in 10 to the 24, the universe either would have, you know, at the Big Bang, exploded out and then quickly collapsed because the density, mass density, was so strong, it would have come back together, big crunch. Or if it was too low, the mass density, it would have just turned into no galaxy formation, no star formation. Either way, no life. Well, what about evolution? What about it? No galaxies. No stars, nothing upon which you can evolve, nothing. All right, gravity, let's just do that. Gravity, finely tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 35th power. You see that formula? F is the force of gravity. G is the gravitational constant. M1 is the mass of one object. M2 is the mass of another object. So M1 could be the sun, M2 could be the Earth, or M1 could be Jupiter, and M2 could be Mars, okay? M1 could change, M2 could change, and then R squared is the radius between those two bodies squared. That could change. So M1 could change, M2 can change, the radius squared can change. The only thing that cannot change is G. The gravitational constant. It has a number in there. I won't write it out for you, but that number needs to be finely tuned to 1 part in 10 to the 35th power. If gravity was any weaker, we wouldn't get hot enough stars to create carbon. Carbon is necessary for life. If it was any stronger, we would have short-lived stars, and the elements that are heavier than carbon and oxygen would be in difficulty. So if gravity was off by this number here, a 1 with 35 zeros after it, we would not have life. Think about that. No stars, no carbon. Definitely not propitious for life, not good for life. If you don't have carbon, you don't have stars, planets, stuff like that. Just so you can grasp this, these exponents are very hard to grasp. A 1 with 35 zeros, what does that even mean? All right, let's say you want to play the Powerball tonight. What are the odds of you winning? 1 in 300 million. We're not even getting close to our number here. What about the number of cells in the human body? There are 37 trillion cells in your body. Imagine you had a surgery where they needed to pull out one cell at random, blindfolded. Would you sign up for that surgery? One in 37 trillion in order to live. What about the number of seconds that the universe has existed? So 13.7 billion years divided up into seconds. That is 10 to the 18th power. So you might be looking at that going, okay, so we're like halfway there. No, these are exponents. Okay, I know I wasn't very good at math either, all right? This isn't halfway. 10 to the 18th, 10 to the 19th is 10 times 10 to the 18th. 10 to the 20th, 100 times. 21st, 1,000 times. We're going all the way up to 10 to the 35th power. Okay, we need an illustration that can capture 10 to the 35th power. Imagine you have a God's eye view of the entire material universe from one end to the other, and you've got a God-sized Stanley tape measure that you can stretch across the entire width of the universe from one end to the other. And you break up the universe into inches. And on that ruler, you move 1 inch to the left, that is life prohibiting. There's no life. You move 1 inch to the right, life prohibiting. No life. It needs to be right in that Goldilocks effect. Not too hard, not too soft, not too hot, not too cold, just right. Right on that 1 inch mark, all the way from one end of the universe to the other. That's what we're talking about here. No, that's not what we're talking about here. Because this illustration is only 10 to the 28th inches. So 10 to the 29th would be 10 times, 10 to the 30th, 100 times, 10 to the 31st, 1,000 times. We're not even getting close. It's difficult to even imagine these figures. But it gets worse. It gets worse. How about the lambda constant, the cosmological constant? This is finely tuned to one part in 10 to the 120th power. That's a 1, it's a 0.000, 120 zeros, and then a 1. If this was any larger, the universe would just be a helium and hydrogen soup. But maybe life could have evolved. In science fiction books and movies, it evolves. In gas clouds of people with high voices, you know, helium. And, you know, that's where it evolves, all right? It doesn't evolve in real life. There's no evolution coming out of a hydrogen and helium soup. Okay, this one is just dirty, all right? The low entropy of the universe. This is one part in 10 to the 10 raised to the 123rd power. You say, what is that number? It's a double exponent. Roger Penrose, an agnostic, he doesn't believe in God. He said to write that number without a double exponent, you would need to write a zero on every subatomic particle in the universe, 10 to the 80, to have enough zeros to write that number. He says, I can cheat. I can cheat and write it with two exponents. Then you say, that's unbelievable. Geraint Lewis, an atheist, and Luke Barnes, in their book, A Fortunate Universe, say it gets worse. You need 10 to the 43 universes of subatomic particles with zeros on them to create that number. What's interesting about that book, A Fortunate Universe, is that it's written by an atheist and a Christian, and in the first 7 chapters, they agree on all the data. The data are all identical. It's in chapters 8, 9, and 10 that they disagree on how to interpret the data. Recently, I made a friend. He said, I'm not sure if I believe in God. So I said, have you ever heard of fine tuning? He said, no, what's that? I just said, Google it. He said, like what website? I'm like, any website. Fine tuning will pop up. This is not creation science. It's not a Christian thing. It's anyone can come up with this. Now, if you want to do the reading, there it is. Penrose, Lewis, Barnes. If you want to get into the books, you got to go to a library. But you can just Google it tonight. Look it up. And one thing that's not really under debate, are the scientific data. The data are very clear, and they're agreed upon. It's the interpretation. Now, if this low entropy of the universe, low entropy, meaning that energy doesn't wind down very fast, well, what if we evolved? No galaxies, stars, or planets. Upon what are you going to evolve? Nothing. So, how many examples of fine-tuning are there? Roughly 30. 30 of these. One of them would be hard to handle. Two, that's brutal. There's 30. There's 30 of these, and they keep getting discovered, and they're not going away. They've been at this for 50 years at this point, and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And the math and the science on this is getting clearer. They're not explaining this away. It's becoming harder and harder to explain away. So let's go back to our sandcastle. What could explain design on this scale? I think some sort of a designer. Even if I never met the designer, I would know someone designed that. And it wasn't a hermit crab, right? I would know it wasn't the wind. It wasn't the waves. But if we use that same logical principle and we look out at our universe, we ask the same question. What could explain this? A universe exquisitely designed, exquisitely finely tuned to the upteenth degree. What could explain that? You would need a designer. You would need someone, a personal agent, to create something of that magnitude. Oh yeah. God has not left himself without testimony, and it is reasonable to see design in nature. Even with these words, they had difficulty keeping the crowd from sacrificing to them. But then some Jews came from Antioch and Iconium, remember 20 miles away, they figured out they're in Lystra, and they won the crowd over. They stoned Paul. They dragged his body outside the city, thinking he was dead. But after the disciples gathered around him, Paul got up and went back into the city. Oh my God, you can't keep this guy down. I remember watching those Rocky movies when I was a kid, you know, and Mick would always be like, stay down, Rock, stay down. You'd always get back up to fight Apollo Creed or the Russian guy or whatever. He was always fighting. Paul would just get hit with a barrage of stones. And they laid him on the ground for dead, and they're like, ah. And they went into the city, and then they leaned over Paul, and then he would just go, ah! And he'd wake back up. And then guess what he would do? March right back into the city. He must have looked gory, like the Walking Dead. I mean, just, I typed this into AI to get it, and they're like, not appropriate. You cannot picture what this would have looked like. And then he's day to day, kind of going like this a little bit to those guys. And the next day, he and Barnabas left for Derbe. They preached the gospel there in that city and won a large number of disciples. And then they returned back from where they came. Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the disciples and encouraging them to remain true to the faith. How about that? How would you like to hear a story about how you should persevere for Christ from a guy who's just totally beaten bloody? They said, we must go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God. So they went back from Derbe there, and it would have been way easier just to go east to Antioch. See what I'm saying? Why did they go west? Because they wanted to build up all of those people that they had just met. It would have been way shorter, probably 200 miles, just to go east. Instead, they went all the way around, hopped on a boat, hit Cyprus, and then went back up into Antioch. We conclude, on arriving in Antioch, Paul and Barnabas gathered the church together and reported all that God had done through them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. And they stayed there a very long time with the disciples. Well, we're seeing in this chapter people's reaction to the evidence for God. And that really asks us a very similar question. How do you react to evidence for the God of the Bible? We saw that some, quote, refused to believe. Verse 2. That happens. Yeah. They just refuse. Not that often. I've met a lot of people. It's very rare. You meet some very militant people, so close-minded they won't even let you speak. You know, it's like, all right, you're refusing. It's not really an act of the intellect. It's an act of the will, where it's like, I won't believe. I won't even be open to believing. That's one option. Another option is that they get even angry and violent. I've never seen the violent part. I've had people get up in my face, you know, yelling. I've had a little bit of spittle, yeah, from people yelling at me. Not that bad, really. Angry, I've had people get angry with me. Again, not that bad. Really makes you wonder why, though. We're talking about an infinite, loving God and that he's real. He wants to bring you with him to have eternal life. He wants to know you. And you're pissed. You're pissed at that. That there is a Father out there that loves you and wants to meet you. And you're angry, even violent. Why is that? Why are you so angry? Huh. Another way to respond would be to be divided over it. That was my friends and I when we heard about this. We lived in a rooming house over on 289 East 14th Avenue. And half of our house heard this message, and we were like, we believe that. Yeah. This has got to be the best thing ever, that God's there, that he's real, that he wants to know us, that he wants to give out eternal life. We heard that. We were like, yeah. Where do we sign? And then the other half of our house, they were like, no, they didn't want to believe in it. And they never really gave any good reasons. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a very thoughtful analysis. It was just kind of like, whatever. Divided over it. That could be a reaction. Another way to react would be to misinterpret the data. See, that's what they did. They thought Paul and Barnabas were Zeus and Hermes. No. They were just ripping their clothes about this, going, no, there's a true God and we're not him. So too, people could hear this and they could be like, well, I guess that means that God's in all of us. I guess that means there is a God and he created the universe, but then he just walked away. No. The God who created all this wants to know you. Wants to know you in a deep, personal way. Wants to encounter you here tonight. What does a God like that need from you? Answer, nothing. Nothing. He doesn't need anything. Here's what he wants. He wants to know you. That's all he wants. When you get older, maybe you'll have children. And if you do, they'll sit up on your lap and talk to you. Jabber at you, you know, maybe even give you a hug. And there's something really special about that. It'd be weird, you know what I mean, if like somebody put them up to doing that. You know, climbing up on your lap, hugging you, I love you, Dad. And you find out somebody paid him $10 to do that. You know what I mean? There's something very sweet. There's something very wholesome about a little child coming up to you and saying, I love you. I went away for a few days a couple weeks ago, and my son wrote a letter to me. It said, I miss you. Mom is great, but you're better. I was like, chill, man. And he was just, you're the best. And so I read that, and I was just like, oh, man. Nothing like that, man. Nothing. And that's what God wants. That's all he wants. He just wants a love relationship with you. To meet with you, but what's stopping that? Not him. He went all the way. I mean, what could he have done that was more than Jesus dying on the cross? Nothing. That's the ultimate gift. The question is, do you want to receive that? Do you want to come and know him? And that's where I fall. I'm into that. Like, receiving that gift, I thought, this is the best thing ever. There's nothing like this out there. And not only do I want to receive that and go to heaven, I want to live for it. Because there's nothing better than living for Christ, nothing close. You know, this world is going to pass away, it's going to be gone, and the only thing that's going to remain is people. And when we get to the end of our lives, if you're a follower of Jesus, there will be no regrets. You're never, ever going to be at the end of your life saying, I wish I gave last to Jesus Christ. It's never going to happen. The only thing you're going to be saying is, I wish I gave a little bit more.